Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Poore, and today's guest is my friend Dan Platt. Okay, Dan is going to talk about the Green Party and presidential politics. Dan was the Green Party candidate for Albany County Executive, and he's going to share his thoughts on what's going on in presidential politics and on the national level. So, Dan, what do you think?
Well, I think that it's great to be here again. And I think that I want to state something about how the Greens, if people aren't aware, are left-leaning and also libertarian-leaning. So we're kind of the best of both of those strains, where we want a decentralized government, but we also want a government that works for people and that creates access to resources, but not through authoritarian or rather punitive means. I like to think of the Greens as being both knowledgeable and imaginative, two qualities that politics these days don't seem to have. You could have knowledgeable candidates who are quote-unquote qualified, but they have no imagination whatsoever. They don't know how to actually solve problems. Or you could have an imaginative candidate who can be broad, speak to people, make connections, and have ideas on the fly, but then have no knowledge or experience in carrying anything out, particularly carrying things out from a bottom-up approach in which people involved that are participatory and follow the kind of values that the Green Party has. That's how I go about describing our local politics, that it's unknowledgeable and unimaginative. On the presidential level, things are kind of progressing. There's more presidential forums happening. There was one yesterday, in New Mexico with the five candidates that are already slated. But there is a sixth candidate entering the race. First, I'll talk about how one becomes a presidential candidate for Greens. The bar is actually very low. You can raise $5,000, or you can petition 100 Greens from a minimum of three states. So you can't all get all your petitions from three states. And it's just a very simple form that you ask someone to fill out that's on the national site to say, I support X for president. And you can do that for multiple people, so you're not limited. And this kind of helps a kind of sixth candidate that wants to be a Green nominee. And his name is Elijah Manley. He's from the Miami area, if I remember correctly. And the interesting thing about him is that he is 17. So he's a teenager. And he's simply running because why not? It's something that he figured he can do or he wants to do. And he is very in line with the Green Party. And, in fact, he was inspired to do this by meeting Jill Stein when she was traveling around and they met in Florida. And he asked her about, you know, him running. And she didn't condescend to say, you're too young. She simply said, the revolution has to start somewhere. And that kind of speaks to her revolutionary politics, that she's no faker. And it's what makes her so popular, both with Greens that are kind of moderate, or rather, not establishment, of course, but more mainstream in their views of how to get things done, how to get people elected. Rather, their position is that the Green Party should focus on winning elections only and not just spreading our ideology, getting awareness up for the Greens first. And that's kind of what the presidential race is about, raising our name brand, our name recognition, the brand, get people interested. And that's kind of what running for office, running for executive positions does. You know, oh, why do you run? You can't win. Well, we're thinking about the long game. And that's kind of why any argument someone makes for Hillary or Sanders is they're also kind of making an argument for the Green Party. I've heard supporters of Hillary, local ones, talk about how, well, you know, a vote for Hillary is still a vote for progress. It's just a very slow, incremental progress. But I would argue it isn't. And if you want incremental progress, you want to support grassroots movements that may take decades to come to fruition, but nonetheless will actually happen and get something done and actually change things on a basic level, rather than a vote for Hillary or Trump, because one of the things to get across to people is that they are on the same team. They go each other's birthdays. They have the same kind of donors. And the same goes for all the local politicians. There's a working-class guy that went to the Hillary rally last week, and he sees Hillary for the phony she is, and had many complaints about the way the rally was organized, why it felt insiders and donors first. They got the cut in line. He got stuck in the cold for 3 hours. That was when this is the day it was snowing. And but he praised John McDonald, Senator McDonald, Fahey, and Senator Gillibrand, and perhaps Tonko as well. But Tonko and Gillibrand basically walked out with Hillary. And he actually said, you know, Hillary's a phony, but Gillibrand was compassionate and moved him. And he said, I would vote for her for president in a heartbeat. She should be the next candidate. Kind of
really?
Missing the point that they're on. Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of perspective that a lot of local voters have. I don't slap them around for it. It's a natural thing to have in our current climate. But the thing I would point out to them, to your listeners, is that missing the point that they are on the same team. Gillibrand walks out with Hillary. They're on the same team. They can talk a little differently. They can have slightly different positions. One can seem more authentic than the other, but they're on the same team. Tonko is on Hillary's team. I've come across a story from Counterpunch that describes the process of how Hillary bought or made a deal with 33 different state Democratic parties and other organizations of why they all support Hillary. And it's basically follow the money. Using current campaign financing laws, which are extremely porous and, of course, corrupt. They work for the 1%. And basically it's a matter of splitting the money. So states like Maine and Montana are getting – the state party is taking these donations from these billionaires and multimillionaires. And then from that pool of money, they're splitting it with Hillary. The state party gets a share of it, and then they endorse Hillary, even though her policy and her platform have nothing to do with their states, not going to support them in any way. It's counter, but it's good for the party. And that is a general problem with the Democratic Party, even on the local level here in New York State. The New York State Party isn't part of this scheme, but you can see it at work, where all of the elected Democrats are endorsing and they're following the leader, whether it's the most progressive of our assemblymen, Fahey and McDonald, or Paul Tonko. But a particular thing they all have in common is they don't talk about the poor. They don't talk about the working class. If a middle class person comes to them with a cause, they'll react and they'll be really good about it. And they'll even come up to working-class neighborhoods sometimes. McDonald did in his first year. He hasn't come back around. This isn't so much a criticism of him as much as the entire structure of the two-party system that people are sick of. And it is my hope that, and it's my goal, that people understand that and then seek the Greens. I recently visited the Greens on campus, the SUNY campus, and they're a small group, but the four of them are all new, and when I asked them, why are you here, meaning like, you know, what brought you to the Green Party in particular, they said, well, the politics are similar. I mean, their views, like, you know, environmentalism, usually the surface of what we're about, but for the most part, they want to fight the two-party system. They know it's corrupt. They know it limits their choices. It limits their freedom. It's not representative. That's why Elijah Manley, the 17-year-old, the main point of his campaign is that not just to run for the sake of running, but to point out that not only is everyone under 18 completely unrepresented because they're not even a franchise. But everyone, as far as the president's concerned, under 35 is unrepresented, right? Because the president has to be over 35.
Mm-hmm.
And this is talking about representation by demographics. We always think about it as geography. But that usually fails on its face. Taking the big, long court battle in Albany County, you get black representation in the county legislature by drawing lines based, you know, with geography in mind. But then, in last year's election, who won one of those safe black districts? Sam Fine. And I've talked to Sam Fine. He's a nice guy. He's young. He's my age. So as far as representing people who are under 35, which the county legislature used to never have, right, it would mostly be a lot of, as far as Democrats concerned, older state workers who have a very bureaucratic mindset. Sam Fine has a little less of that. So my opinions are, you know, mixed but generally positive about him. But otherwise, he is white, and he's supposedly representing a black district that was drawn and sued over, and a lot of money. It cost a lot of money. It was one of the issues of the campaign last year, and it didn't work. Representation, if we want representation to be by demographics, we need to reform our election system, which is what Greens are for. You know, we want we want proportional, you know, elections. We want ranked choice ballots so that it isn't winner take all. Those kind of reforms, and there are also really big fundamental constitutional reforms as well, which it's not about just rolling back the bad stuff that's happened, because that stuff is really hard to do. Once something is in place and it's part of how things work, you know, your general Democratic Party politicians will not actually work to do anything against that, because if they do, their funding is going to get cut. Just as a nonprofit doesn't rock the boat too hard, our assembly people, who will do work for the people generally when it comes to getting, you know, funding and money and such, and working for issues, won't rock the boat too much, because they don't want the party machine, or rather the party in general and all these other organizations, to turn against them, which they can and historically will, or they will not get the donors, they won't get the campaign financing that they need to run a reelection campaign, or, you know, to stave off any challenger, or even the threat of any challenger.
I'm looking right now, I'm looking at Jill Stein's Twitter feed, and I think one of the things that has made Donald Trump so successful is the fact that he uses social media to his advantage. You're talking party politics, but technology has changed the way you can get a message out. And I think Jill Stein should harness that technology and get her message out where everybody can hear what she has to say. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely necessary. It's what she's doing. I just saw a little story. You know, it's one of those little tiny, almost fringe stories, but basically Van Jones, green job czar of the Obama administration that was run out purportedly by Glenn Beck, he's kind of a shill for CNN, and CNN endorsed, you know, it's for Hillary, at least the CEO is, or at least because CNN is owned by, let's see, who they own by, a larger company that obviously donates to Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
Just as MSNBC is owned by GE, which donates to Hillary. So, yes, the liberal network is, in fact, not so much. But as far as social media is concerned, it's kind of double-edged. In more radical circles, there's conversations about how social media, it allows companies that, you know, own the meme, you know, the means of the distribution. Total control over our information. You know, you sign those little agreements and all these other, you know, proprietary information. And it's for profit. You know, they sell it to other, they sell information to companies, and that's usually how they make the money, because we, the users of Facebook or Twitter, are the product. So there's that dimension of it, that there is a kind of way of, you know, we're against the state from collecting information on us, but not when it's a company. But perhaps when, you know, the state isn't giving us anything in return, it isn't building these platforms that we use. That we generally find extremely useful. But, yeah, so it's not really about there. But anyway, Van Jones tweeted a little thing about, you know, to state his own independence. Someone commented to him, you know, I've been watching you on CNN for a good while now, and I haven't seen you actually endorse a candidate yet. And he basically said, well, you know, I'm fiercely independent. I haven't. I might vote for Jill Stein. And then she said, and he, you know, puts at Jill Stein, at Green Party. So those little hashtags, those little tags, then can connect his followers, which are in the hundreds of thousands, I think it's over a million, to then Jill Stein. And that's the power of Twitter. Anyone who's following one person will see it if they're looking. Same with Facebook. But Facebook is becoming more of a morass, because the Zuckerberg machine so far is changing. You know, they are in control of algorithms that do, in fact, control what you see. It's not just a matter of liking every page that you actually want to see more of. It's based on what you type. It's based on what you search for. It's based on what you read. And it can create an echo chamber for yourself. I think one positive suggestion is to never like anything. Just comment. If you comment on something, you'll see more of that thing. If you like something, it'll give you more of similar content. Because like there was this guy who did this little social experiment on himself. He liked everything, and it created a mind tunnel from which he, you know, which really kind of destroyed his life, or at least his mental space. And then then he changed it around, or someone else did, and commented on everything, and found that he was, in fact, having more conversations, and his social platform was making him more social. Liking everything made him the other guy less social. Now, as far as organizing is concerned, Facebook and social media is a tool, all right? And a tool is only as useful as the person wielding it, or in this context, groups that wield it. So when it comes to, let's say, organizing a protest, let's say you have the Trump rally tomorrow, there are now, I think, at least two or three different events that have been created by individuals. Block hate, you know, maybe they have different tones to them based on the person who created them and their community that is joining them, so maybe two different, you know, sets of groups will show up, and then they'll make one group when they get there. But otherwise, in other countries, let's say, I'll share this with you because this comes from this is undercurrent news here. Now that there's a lull in fighting in Syria, street protests have begun again. The peaceful, nonviolent revolution that started that war, that the Assad regime started shooting at, they're back in the street. And every week they have a different theme. And I think this week's theme is the revolution doesn't die, but won't end. Until, you know, demands or things actually get better. And they are, in fact, continuing to demand that Assad leave his post and that they have a new government with democratic elections. And they do have people with guns defending these street protests, but otherwise they are organized by a deliberate coordinating committee that is in each city, and then these committees then decide amongst themselves what the theme will be. Occupy movement is similar. There was a group in each city, and these groups under the umbrella of Occupy communicated with each other about themes and actions and what will be a big day of action, and each Occupy had its own working group which is another name for a committee, I guess, the Direct Action Working Group. And the Direct Action Group would basically not decide for everyone else, but with input, but they were basically the people who kind of were the arbiters of, you know, what will be the theme, what will be the targets. Now, it made them kind of a place for a lot of arguments and conflict, and, you know, negative conflict, when people are like, why aren't we protesting here? Why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we doing that? That's just call for forming your own committee. But generally, we don't have that anymore in Albany. We have all these different groups that do their own protests about their own issues that people can join, and that's good. But when it comes to on-the-fly issues like Trump's coming to town, then there's no, unless there's an anti-Trump group, which doesn't exist, it's up to individuals to post their event, post a event. Perhaps the Sanders campaign people locally can be the people who respond to Trump. But then the event will have a succinct tone, right, a pro-Bernie tone.
Right.
And thus it's not kind of, it's more fabricated, less generated. That's kind of, I've been reading, as an architect, I read about design, and something that applies to politics as well is the difference between a generated design that's natural and human and a fabricated design, which is kind of willful and just placed on and doesn't make sense because the example was a house and garden. Usually the conventional wisdom, you place the house first and then you place the garden in the leftover space. But what if you place the garden first in the most beautiful area and then you place the house to work with the garden? And that increases, and that makes both better. The same goes for politics, that conventional wisdom always seems to put the cart before the horse, that you win elections first and then you get things done. But the Green Party's process is to decentralize things and organize people first, and then with those organizations, with getting people on the same page, having these coordinating committees who are good at organizing the protests and thus also organizing outreach and then get out the vote, then can elect people who are then truly representative or as delegates rather than a singular person who happens to have get enough donations from certain people or certain constituencies, which then they will represent, but it won't be everybody. And hopefully, with this election cycle, maybe by the end of it, maybe in the middle, people will start to realize that the arguments they make for or against Hillary, whether it's about qualifications or do they have a plan, they'll start to realize that their mindset is almost futile. And that either the president shouldn't matter because we want an actual representative democracy, all right, in the minds of liberals and moderates and whatever, and non-radical people, non-revolutionary people, or they realize that they do in fact want a president that can do anything and is in fact a dictator who has all these powers that are unconstitutional. Hopefully, also another point to make is that the Constitution is this outdated document that people seem to have a dogma about, that they treat it like the Bible, that the just as we shouldn't take our morality from a 2,000-year-old document, I don't think we should take our form of government for these times from a 200-year-old document. Even though it's been amended slightly with vague generalities like the 14th Amendment, which gives, you know, which is about personhood. The rest were just little tweaks, which barely solved any problems. And we need to think about either, you know, a new constitution or just a real shaking up of how a government works, what it's based on. Because otherwise you kind of get in this trap where one of the contradictions of America is that our Constitution, you know, you say, where our laws come from? The Constitution. How is the Constitution crafted? By a series of illegal acts. So it's really counterproductive to say you can't get political change by breaking the law or by being disruptive or by confronting people who are in opposition to you in terms of worldview, right? Sanders supporters versus Trump supporters, or left-wingers versus right-wingers. I lost my thought.
Yeah. I'll give you a thought. What are the three most important issues that Jill Stein is talking about in the presidential campaign this year?
Oh, what are the three most important issues? Well, I would point out what sets her apart the most, because I hear a lot of people saying, well, Sanders and Stein are practically the same person. Not so. I'll point out one on the college debt issue. Stein and the General Green Party is for abolishing that debt. It's in the president's power to revoke a lot of the college debt, especially the federal debt that me and Colin Thomas, who you had last week, have. We have debt through the federal loan program. They're making money off of us. And
right.
And Sanders' program, besides not fixing the problem of bloated colleges raising their growing their administration costs to the point of sinking and making colleges more like businesses, I don't think his plan addresses that. Jill will. Another issue is Syria and foreign policy. With the Syria case, the policy, the plank in the Stein campaign, is a weapons embargo, right? If the problem is it's a powder keg and there's a lot of weapons going in through many different countries, but where do Saudi Arabia get their weapons? Us. And Sanders' kind of line on it is to get Saudi Arabia to do more in the region. They're the people who are fanning the flames and funding all of the al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-like groups, like the al-Nusra Front and et cetera, the groups that are doing the most harm and damage and need to be fought. Saudi Arabia is our principal ally, basically cutting the heads off of women who decide to drive. And we don't embargo them. We don't put sanctions on them, but we'll put sanctions on North Korea and Iran because we don't like them. They don't follow the rules. But all the other countries who, like Turkey, right, they're our big ally, but they're bombing the Kurds. They're bombing whoever fits their agenda. And then you have Russia in there, and it's a big mess. But what does it all have in common? Weapons coming in, flowing out, flowing in. Now, the fighting has been lulled a bit. At least the bombing is a trickle now. So things are getting better, fine. But if we want to prevent these things in the future, we need to think about our policy when it comes to exporting weapons. Now, of course, the gun makers and the tank makers will not like that. But guess what? We're spending billions and billions of dollars. A meme that's been going around is that a Javelin missile, this is a kind of shoulder-mounted rocket launcher, but it's like your own personal missile launcher, is each round in a Javelin is $80,000. And the meme is that you have a rocket being fired by someone who doesn't make that in a year at someone who doesn't make that in a lifetime.
Right.
And that's the horror of our military machine. And it's all for profit generation. That's the only people who seem to benefit. Not even dictators seem to benefit because they get the axe in the end. And the third issue I can't think of readily at the moment, but let's say it's the energy policy, where we call for 100% renewables. There's wave power. That's been going around. Obviously, offshore wind. Wind potential is big. And there are plans for getting it done. It's just a matter of having the investment and saying the government will do this because markets have it. Markets have failed. It's not providing renewable energy. If anything, it's exacerbating our environmental problems because market logic does not take what's called externalities, which are like externalities are pollution, negative consequences. Pollution, poverty, and other things are not taken into account. The price of your Big Mac is not just the labor cost or the ingredients. There's all these other costs that are being left out. If we have the true cost of things, it would, well, consumerism would be a thing of the past. And that can be a little scary for people. But slow, deliberate changes. You know, just as conversation about microaggressions, micro-resistance to these systems of control and, you know, and bossiness and let's say, general assholelessness. To resist these things in little ways adds up, just as the small injustices of one person having control over another, whether it's in an airport line or at the DMV or a bureaucracy or a company or a bank. It's all kind of a similar mindset of top-down versus bottom-up, fairness versus dog-eat-dog. And too many liberals are stuck with this dog-eat-dog mentality of market logic, how we have to do things by markets. It's a dogma. It's a myth. Got to get that across. Before time runs out, I just want to lay out how New York picks our presidential candidate, the Green Party.
Okay.
Our convention is June 11th at the Center for Independent Media in Troy. It's usually held there. And probably 50 people attend. You said you went last year. I haven't. I will be going this year. For people in the Capital District, very convenient. If you're not in the Capital District, not so convenient. But the point is, anyone who's a Green, registered Green, can vote in our convention for president. So it's just kind of, I think it's a straight winner-take-all vote. I'm not particularly sure. I think there might be, there is runoff voting. But if someone gets more than 50% the first time, then they're declared the winner. So there are mail-in ballots, just like an absentee ballot. Any registered Green can go to the state party website. It's not up yet. It should be soon. But there's a ballot. You get this ballot, you mail it in, and then boom, you've made your vote for a presidential candidate. Much less complicated than the primary system, which is left up to local control, where, you know, if you saw in Arizona and other states, other primaries, you have the state parties that are doing their best to make sure that insurgency voters, independent voters who may be voting the first time in a long while because Sanders is just a compelling candidate, they're being left out in the cold. Their ballot may not be counted. There's a lot of shenanigans happening, but pretty much illegal or immoral things, or things that aren't particularly illegal because the laws have been changed to benefit, say, the Clinton campaign or the establishment campaign is a better way to put it. And in a general call, I have to make a general call against lesser evilism, which is kind of, it's almost an ideology in itself, that one must vote for a lesser evil. That if Trump is the nominee, unlikely, but let's say it's Kasich or Cruz. Sorry, I keep calling him Kasich, but that's a senator. Kasich or Cruz.
Kasich.
Hmm?
Right.
Yeah.
It's Kasich.
Kasich. All right. I'll get it right eventually. And let's say they're a Republican nominee. They're both equally terrible, terrible people. But there's still the separation that Clinton is somehow better. That if it's between them and her, got to vote for Clinton, got to vote for the Democrat. But as far as corporate policy, even as far as social issues, all right, what has Obama done to defend Planned Parenthood? You know, a little statement here or there. Now, true, Obama has been open to doing things that likely Republican president wouldn't. Let's say opening relations with Cuba. But the ship of state has not really veered that very much. There's kind of a cruise control put on the wheel, let's say, if we're using a ship metaphor. That electing Hillary, or Obama. You know, Hillary will basically be continuation. I've heard it said that we basically have the same president for the last 20 years, you know, my lifetime. Since Reagan, we've had the same president. It's really all just been a different face and a different tone, perhaps. But otherwise, the big things that get done are done along the same neoliberal or neoconservative consensus between both parties. People will respond when I argue this that no, there's still substantial differences between the parties. But if food stamps are getting cut, if, as they are, if wars are being perpetuated, we're still oppressing other countries, we're still oppressing our own people, black lives are still being killed, police oppression and police abuse, and there's barely any apology for any of it. You know, to working class people, there is no difference. If you're middle class, there's a difference. So it's really a class difference. So that's important. That's why there's a split. Clinton supporters are usually middle class professionals, and Sanders supporters are not, but also there's a lot of overlap because, you know, a lot of the middle class is working class now. It's important to realize that middle class is still working class, whether you have a salary or a wage. You're being screwed. But there's hope. There's ways of fighting back. And that's what the Green Party is a tool for. Social media is a tool for that. And I've seen more people get active and involved and interested and wanting to know more, like the Campus Greens. They want to know more. They're there to learn. So I actually went to visit to kind of do a teaching for them, tell them about my campaign, what I learned from it. And if we told them the outreach, and the same goes for us. I plan on outreaching with other few other Greens and maybe you at the Sanders rally tomorrow. Very positive. We keep it constructive. We're not there to confront or whatever. Literally just have a good conversation. Oh, yes. I want to point out that the local Green Party, Upper State Greens, are finally having monthly meetings. Scheduled every second Wednesday at the Honest Way Food Co-op at 7 o'clock. That should be really good because we're going to talk candidates there. We're going to talk our means of printing flyers in an organized manner so we can get things done, so we can have that outreach. And generally, get out the good news that there is a third party, and most people are independents, and they think of themselves as independents, and they are the majority. And the argument to make is, that I will make, is that if you're independent, you need an independent party, and Democrats are not that. Even if you run as an independent within the Democrats, they will either crush you or consume you. It's kind of one or the other. Even if you're elected on a grassroots wave, like these Bernie-crats, although I'm really skeptical. Some of these Bernie-crats literally just have one plank in common with Bernie, and then they're just kind of they're normal Dem through and through. So I wouldn't hold my breath for them to bring about drastic changes. But it's all incremental. The means are very important. Are they grassroots enough? Are they participatory enough? Just electing new representatives isn't enough. You need collective power. Otherwise, you're stuck as an individual, and you are, as you find, powerless. But we're stronger together.
So then, before or after the state convention in Albany, Troy, will you come back on Focus on Albany and talk about the convention and what was decided at that point?
Yeah. I'll also point out that we're out of time.
Is Jill Stein going to be there?
I don't know, but a goal for us in the Campus Greens is to have Stein at SUNY Albany or some other place by September. Particularly in September when the students are coming back.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're not going to have a rally with her right before the election. We'll have one in the middle.
Okay. So, you know, as things progress, will you come back and talk about the Green Party again and focus on Albany?
Of course.
Thank you. You've been listening to Dan Platt, and he's been talking about the Green Party and presidential politics. If you like this show, like Focus on Albany on Facebook, on Twitter, and if you have comments or criticisms, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter and share your thoughts. Dan, have a wonderful day. Thank you, and thank you, everybody, for listening.